Welcome to SCOTUS Cast, a project of the Federalist Society for Law and Public Policy Studies. Our contributors join us from around the country to bring you expert commentary on U.S. Supreme Court cases as they are argued and the decisions are issued. The Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions are those of the speaker.
Hello, and welcome to SCOTUS Cast. I'm your host, Kyle Hammernis, on behalf of the Faculty Division of the Federalist Society. We are here today to discuss McIntosh versus United States, in which the Supreme Court issued a 9-0 decision on April 17th, 2024. It is my honor to introduce our guest today, Stefan Casella. Stefan serves as an expert witness and consultant to law enforcement agencies and the private sector as the CEO of Asset Forfeiture Law, LLC. Previously, he was the deputy chief and then the chief of the Asset Forfeiture and Money Laundering section in the U.S. Attorney's Office in Baltimore, Maryland. And with that, I'd like to turn things over to our guest to discuss the overview of the case and the court's decision.
Well, thank you very much. This was a criminal forfeiture procedural decision, and the court has not made many decisions on that particular aspect of asset forfeiture, so it's unusual in that regard. But it's strictly a case of statutory interpretation, and in fact, it's a case of the interpretation of a rule of criminal procedure that was last amended in 2009, and this is the first time the Supreme Court has had any occasion to write about it. The criminal forfeiture is part of the sentence in a criminal case. So just as the amount of time a defendant might be incarcerated, or the amount of fine he might pay, or the amount of restitution he might be ordered to pay, the amount of a criminal forfeiture, or whether there's even going to be a criminal forfeiture, does not come up until there's a conviction. At that time, according to the rules, and the rule in question is Rule 32.2, Federal Rules of Criminal Procedure, there are three things that the court needs to do after there's a conviction in a case in which forfeiture is requested by the government. The first is to ascertain whether the defendant wants the jury retained to consider the forfeiture. The second is to enter a preliminary order of forfeiture sufficiently in advance of sentencing to allow the parties to comment and to suggest any corrections. And the third is at sentencing to include the forfeiture in the oral announcement of the sentence and in the written judgment. And it's the second of those that was at issue here. The rule says that unless doing so is impractical, the trial judge should enter a preliminary order of forfeiture in advance of sentence, sufficiently in advance of sentence to allow the parties to comment and to suggest corrections. And the court did not do that in McIntosh's case. So when it came to sentencing, there was some interlocutory appeal up to the Supreme Court and back again, but that's not relevant, up to the Court of Appeals, but that's not relevant here. When it came to sentencing, the court went ahead and entered the forfeiture order. And Mr. McIntosh's counsel argues that because the court didn't follow the rule about entering preliminary orders, that was fatal, and that the court was now barred from entering the order. The district court disagreed and said, no, it's requirement in the rule about entering a preliminary order is a time-related directive. It's not a mandatory rigid rule, and it does not bar me from going ahead and entering the forfeiture order, subject to a harmless error analysis, and the court found any error was harmless. The defendant was well aware from the indictment and from all the proceedings during the case, he'd gotten a bill of particulars that the government was going to seek forfeiture, and so this didn't prejudice him that the court didn't enter the preliminary order. He appealed to the Second Circuit. The Second Circuit agreed with the district court. There was no error. And he filed a cert petition. And the case goes to the Supreme Court. It was argued just a few weeks ago. A unanimous court says the lower courts were both correct. This was a time-related directive. And there was no fatal error that precluded the district court from entering the forfeiture order. Which, of course, is significant because Mr. McIntosh had been convicted of several Hobbs Act robberies. He had obtained $75,000 in proceeds, and had used the money to buy a BMW, and the government wanted to take the BMW, and it would have been a windfall to him if the district court's failure to enter the preliminary order of forfeiture barred the forfeiture. So the court says there was an error, certainly, but it was not a fatal error, and there was no reason the court could not proceed. So the property was forfeited. So what's unusual about this case is that generally the Supreme Court only grants cert to resolve a split in the circuits or to resolve a constitutional issue. There's no constitutional issue here. It's purely a matter of procedure. And the court found that as a matter of procedure, interpreting the rule, that this was not anything more than a time-related directive. They had three reasons for that, by the way. That one was that the rule itself says, unless doing so is impractical, which suggests that this is not a rigid rule. Second, that the rule is directed at what the court should do, not at what the government should do. So it wasn't the government's violation, it was the judge's violation. And then also there was no provision in Rule 32.2 which suggests in any way what the sanction should be for the court's failure to do this. In other situations in which the court has found a rule to be rigid and requires some more severe sanction, the rule itself provides for that, and there was no such provision in this rule that suggests any kind of detriment to the government's forfeiture action if the rule is not followed. So for all those reasons, the court said there was no preclusion of the forfeiture. But why did they grant cert when there was no split in the circuits on this question? In fact, every court that has addressed the issue has found exactly the same way. And the reason is that the defendant, Mr. McIntosh, in making his cert petition, conflated two different rules. There is another, remember I said there were three different stages in the proceeding. The third stage is what the rule says the court must do at the sentencing hearing itself. And if the court fails to make the forfeiture part of the oral announcement of the sentence and include it in the judgment, the circuits are split as to whether that is fatal or is not fatal. Some courts say that if the court doesn't impose it as part of his sentence, it's too late to fix it later. Other courts say otherwise. Now, that's a question on which the court might have someday to grant cert to resolve a split in the circuits. But it didn't do that in this case because that wasn't the issue in this case. In this case, the issue was the preliminary order, and there was no split in the circuits. But it appears from the cert petition that counsel cited the cases on the latter rule in suggesting that there was a split in the circuits, and the court took the case and then found that there was no significant controversy. In fact, there's a footnote that Justice Sotomayor, who wrote the opinion for the unanimous court, drops that says, it looks like there's less than meets the eye when it comes to a split in the circuits. And what she's referring to is exactly the point that I'm making, that the split was on a different rule, not on this one. Now, one other interesting thing about the opinion is that the court says, well, while the error was the judge's error, and while the rule doesn't place any responsibility on the government in this instance, Justice Department policy is nevertheless to tell its prosecutors to remind judges of their duty to do what the rule requires. Justice Department policy requires or instructs its prosecutors to submit a proposed preliminary order in advance of sentence so that the court is reminded of its duty to do so. And the government did not do that in this case. And the court says, we hope, well, I think her phrase, Justice Sotomayor's phrase is, this is an instance which the government failed to follow its policy, which this court considers to be a rare occurrence, suggesting that the court would look with disfavor if this kind of problem occurs frequently in the future. And so that's something that Justice Department, I'm sure, will be reminding its prosecutors about.
That was a great overview of just the case in general and the decision. I did want to ask, right, about, you know, what you see or what you may want to predict going forward, especially regarding the litigation surrounding that other section that you mentioned, but also, right, before we get to that, what would be the remedy for a mistake like this that happens, right? I mean, whether it's the judges or now possibly if the prosecutors fail to remind the judges, what would be the remedy for that?
Well, what the court says is that it's still subject to harmless error analysis. So if you have a situation where you come to sentencing and the defendant had no clue that the government was seeking forfeiture, he is totally surprised, then he could argue prejudice because he could say the court was supposed to enter a preliminary order before sentence to give me notice of what was going to happen here, and my counsel would have then had time to suggest that the amount of the money judgment the government was seeking or the forfeiture of the BMW or whatever it is was mistaken for whatever reason, lack of sufficient evidence to meet the preponderance standard, or they just named the wrong asset or they calculated it wrong. Then he could argue that the error was not harmless. And so that would be the remedy. But in this case, the government had included a forfeiture notice in the indictment and had served him with a bill of particulars indicating that it was seeking the forfeiture of his BMW. They just hadn't reminded the judge that you're supposed to enter a preliminary order before sentencing. And the court said, in that instance, it's a harmless error.
Okay. And then regarding the other section, right, section B of that, section four, is it?
B4.
Yeah. So do you expect to see them grant cert on a case in the coming years, or do you think that this is so rare that it really will not get up to the court?
I think that they'll probably let the issue percolate in the circuits for a while longer, because now there is some guidance from the court on what the considerations are. Remember, I said there were three factors that they considered in determining that the rule in question, the preliminary order rule, which is rule B2, was only a time-related directive. And two of those suggest that violation of the third part, rule B4, would be time-related as well. It doesn't include any sanction in the rule itself, and it is directed at something the court should do. It's not directed at something the litigants should do. And the government is certain to argue, citing those two points in McIntosh, that the failure to enter the order of forfeiture as part of the oral announcement at sentencing likewise is only a time-related directive, and that the failure to enter it is not fatal. And it will make that argument in all of the circuits where the issue has not yet been resolved, and that's most of them. Only two circuits have held that it's a fatal error. But in support of the argument that it's a fatal error, defendants are likely to argue the third point, which is that whereas the preliminary order provision talks about unless doing so is impractical and has vague language like sufficiently in advance of sentence, rule B4 is very specific. The court must enter the forfeiture as part of the oral announcement of the sentence and must include it in the judgment. And defendants will argue that means that a defendant is entitled to know all aspects of his sentence at one time. How long am I going to jail? What's the period of supervised release? What fine shall I pay? What special assessment? What restitution? And what forfeiture order? All at one time. So there will be some tension because the three factors that the court, through Justice Sotomayor, considered go two different ways when you apply them to Rule B4. And so will there continue to be a split in the circuits? Will the two circuits that said that this is a fatal error, change their minds now that they've seen the analysis in McIntosh? Or will other circuits say that those courts were correct now that they've seen the analysis in McIntosh? And I suspect we'll see a continuous evolution of the law. Unfortunately, it's not all that rare. It's not all that rare for a judge to sentence the defendant and fail to enter the forfeiture order then and there, either because the prosecutor forgets to remind the judge or because the prosecutor brings it up, but the judge says, I'm not ready. Why don't we do it next week? Or, you know, something else like that happens. I mean, there was a famous among forfeiture practitioners colloquy one time where the judge says to the prosecutor, what about the forfeiture? This is at the sentencing hearing. And the prosecutor says, oh, Your Honor, they will take care of that later, meaning somebody else in the office who handles forfeitures. And no, they don't handle that later. It has to be, the rule says, do it at sentencing. Now, there is a provision in the rules elsewhere that says if it's not possible to calculate the exact amount of the forfeiture judgment or not possible to identify all the specific property, the court can enter an order at sentencing in general terms. In other words, the defendant shall forfeit all proceeds of his crime and leave the amount of the calculation to a later hearing. That would comply with the rule. Then then everybody agrees there'd be no fatal error. But if the judge does nothing and then a week later, a month later, a year later, the prosecutor says, oh, by the way, Your Honor, you remember that sentencing we did some time ago? We never got a forfeiture order. That's the situation where some courts say too late and some courts say it's okay.
All right. Well, thank you so much for breaking it down for us, Steph. Really, really enjoyed having you on. Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUSCast. SCOTUSCast is a project of the Federalist Society, a not-for-profit educational organization of conservative and libertarian law students, law professors, and lawyers. Founded upon the principles that the state exists to preserve freedom, that the separation of governmental powers is essential to our Constitution, and that it is emphatically the province and duty of the judiciary to say what the law is, not what it should be. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast series, including SCOTUSCast and Practice Group Podcasts, on iTunes or Google Play. For an archive of past podcasts, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at fedsoc.org/multimedia. That's FEDSOC.org/multimedia.
This has been a FedSoc audio production.